watching the watchers. A state investigation is underway into the firm that catches red light runners on camera. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9, and now never miss a show. Catch our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we'll take your calls on the controversy around Florida's red light traffic cameras. What do you think? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, how you can get the dollars to fund your creative ideas and light a spark in downtown Jacksonville. Plus, Culpepper on the Armada's big win. All of that ahead this hour. But first this morning, those traffic red light cameras that have their eyes trained on you are now under the microscope themselves. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement is going to investigate whether a political bribery scandal at a company that sells the cameras extends to contracts with five Florida cities, including here in Jacksonville. The Chicago Tribune reported last month that the former CEO of Redflex pleaded guilty in a federal bribery probe. Also, the Tribune uncovered wrongdoing in a Chicago contract with Redflex. The allegations involved bribes paid to a politically connected former city official. Now, Redflex operates the cameras at intersections around this city and in other cities. And so we begin the hour with a closer look. Here in studio, Mark Seiden, attorney and professor with Florida Coastal School of Law. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us by phone, Paul Henry, a retired Florida state trooper who's been lobbying against the red light cameras in the state via the Liberty First Network. Paul, thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to news that the FDLE will investigate the state's red light cameras, the firm that operates them, in Jacksonville and other cities? What's your opinion about the cameras? What are your questions? Give us a call, 549-2937, 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We're already getting your comments on our Facebook page as well. Retired Trooper Henry, let's begin with you. You've been speaking out against these cameras for several years now. What's your initial reaction to news that the FDLE is investigating Redflex?
I'm ecstatic. 2 years ago, I filed a written complaint with the Attorney General and with the Governor over some apparent financial misconduct to the tune of several million dollars, and it was never investigated. So I'm just very pleased that this alleged misconduct that took place in other cities is now going to be investigated here in Florida.
Mark Seiden, let's find out what the Chicago Tribune reported last month. What they're reporting is that the former CEO of Redflex was allegedly paying off city officials, bribing city officials up in Cook County. How does this impact the investigation here in Florida, in your view?
I think the investigation starts out with a strike against Redflex right at the very beginning. And Redflex has a compliance center they've instituted, and in their website, they admit that their employees engage in unethical practices in conjunction with the contracts for the cameras. I think the cameras are nothing more than income generation for Redflex and for the city, and I think their safety value is quite dubious.
What about law enforcement officials such as former Sheriff John Rutherford who've said, look, these decrease the number of accidents at intersections?
Well, I'd need to see objective proof of that. First of all, John and I are good friends, and I want to state that at the very beginning, but I disagree with him on the efficacy of those red light cameras. I think they have a potential to cause more rear-end accidents than anything else.
There is some data to support that. Paul Henry, that's an argument you've made, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I went to the DOT personally, and I got gigabytes of all of the traffic crash data for a 7-year period, which included equal periods before and after the cameras. And without exception, every city that I looked at in Florida that used these cameras, they had more crashes after camera use. And the thing is, it's not just limited to these rear-end crashes. There are other types of crashes that increase as well. And so this whole, I call it a smokescreen of safety that's used to justify these things, it's been blown away to the so much so that the officials themselves stopped using safety as a claim probably a couple of years ago, and they started saying, well, it changes driver behavior. And yet the problem is, when they talk about these crashes, they never talk about red light violation crashes. You look at the state reports and you see side impact. Of course, they've done away with that now, the latest 2014 version. So we don't really know how effective they are. I do because I've looked at the data and they're not effective.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment as we discuss FDLE's pending investigation into Redflex, the company that operates red light cameras in five Florida cities, including Jacksonville. Lots of calls already at 549-2937. Mark Seiden, Redflex CEO, former CEO Karen Finley, has already pleaded guilty to federal conspiracy charges in Ohio, accused of bribing officials in Columbus, Cincinnati. She and Redflex face similar charges in Chicago, but there has been no evidence as yet about any bribes being offered by officials in Florida. We're talking Clearwater, Miami, Jacksonville, Kissimmee, and Pinecrest. Those are the five Florida cities that hold a contract with Redflex. We do need to point that out.
Yes, and I think the investigation will be illuminative. Either there has been bribery or there hasn't. We certainly hope that there hasn't. But nonetheless, again, the motivation is money. Redflex makes money off of these cameras. I'm not sure what their cut is, but other companies take as much as 40% of every ticket in terms of revenue. And I think that's really a shame. It's a motivation for the system to produce more tickets, more fines, and to do other things, such as there's been allegations in some circles that they cut the yellow light time to make the violations easier to catch.
549-2937. What are your thoughts and questions about the pending investigation into Redflex and red light cameras here in our area? Daryl in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think it should be a surprise to anybody that the law is being used to extort money from the citizens. It's done all over in different ways. This is just now in using technology to extort money from the citizens. Technology and the law to extort money from the citizens. And it's done all automatically, so you really don't have to have a citizens. Don't really have to have employees to do this. The city gets a cut, the company gets a cut, and they send you a picture and a bill. And if you don't pay it, we're going to ruin your credit. And, you know, when the citizens can put an equivalent penalty on the police sheriff department and the company, equivalent to a credit report, in other words, a review that docks them in the same penalty manner as the citizens, then we'll have a fair and balanced thing. The other option is to put all of this money in a general fund that neither the company or the city and sheriff's department receives, and watch these red lights go away, because it is nothing more than an extortion of money from the citizens by using the law to do it.
That's Daryl down in St. Augustine. Paul Henry.
Daryl makes some good points there, and pardon the pun, but he's right on the money. I did an analysis of the city of Tallahassee, where I live, this year, and they've been losing money since July 2013, since the DOT ordered them to add just 0.4 of a second and to make their turn and three-lane times identical. And you had some yellow light times increase close to 2 seconds after that was done, and the crash rate just dropped. As of course, the violation rate did, too. And the thing is, what a lot of these supporters of cameras say is that, well, if you add too much yellow time, people are going to run red lights anyway. Well, what they're saying is that we expect by nature people want to run red lights, and the exact opposite is true. No sane person or sober person that I'm aware of is going to come up to a red light that's been red for 4 seconds and say, oh, I think I want to drive through that.
To play devil's advocate, Mark Seiden, law enforcement agencies that have contracted to bring Redflex into their cities don't believe that argument. They think this is an effective deterrent.
Well, I don't think the numbers bear that out. And I think what we have to look at is this just merely another way to pick the citizen's pocket the way SunPass does? When SunPass first came out, it was great. You could drive down the turnpike and not have to stop at a toll booth. But in the city that I moved out of, Miami, there's SunPass all over. You can't drive a mile and a half on the expressway without getting hit again, and there's nothing that you can do about it. So I think the red light cameras fall in the same category. All they do is generate income. I think the secondary consideration is safety, and that safety consideration has yet to be proved.
And we want your calls into the pending state investigation into the company that operates red light cameras in five Florida cities, including Jacksonville. We'll go to your emails, tweets, and Facebook comments in just a moment. 549-2937 to join us. Tom is in San Marco. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Hi. Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Go ahead.
Okay, if it's not about revenue, why isn't there a big red sign in the block before the red light camera that says, warning, red light camera ahead, you will be fined? There's never any sign that warns you that they're there. So I'm thinking that it's obviously a revenue. I'll let everybody go now.
All right, thanks, Tom. Paul Henry, there are red light cameras at several intersections all around Jacksonville. Some of them do say photo enforced, not all of them. There are signs in some intersections, though. But what about his comment?
If I'm not mistaken, I believe the law does require a posting of that. The ones up here certainly have it. Up in Tallahassee, I can't answer because I don't travel over there in Jacksonville. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe the law does say that. If I can just piggyback on a comment earlier, though, one of my main complaints about this whole scheme is that it turns law enforcement, my former profession, into a for-profit activity. And that's never a good thing. I recall many a time writing a ticket to someone and they're saying, oh, well, the Highway Patrol gets this money. And I would correct them and say, no, the Highway Patrol does not get money from these tickets. Look where you're paying the money. It goes to the clerk of the court, then it goes to general revenue. And so that was always a good way to distance ourselves from the financial motive for writing tickets. And the opposite is just the case here. We've had in Gulfreeze a police chief that has set himself up for a $2,000 a month post-retirement income thanks to the red light cameras. So it's for-profit policing is just a bad idea in my book.
Mike in Arlington. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. How are y'all doing this morning?
Doing good, thanks.
Well, the previous caller hit a lot of the points that I was that I would have hit. Or planned on hitting, but, you know, I think one of the biggest frustrations that a lot of people have with regards to this is, you know, we're seeing a lot of instances where corporations are inserting themselves between municipalities and law enforcement vehicles and corrections issues where you've got, you know, the private prison industry, you've got private toll collectors, you've got folks that are handling bail for court systems. You've got companies like Aramark that are providing food to the prison industries, and they are rife with abuse, corruption, and more importantly, a almost complete disregard of redress from the citizens on any problems, issues, anything like that. And I understand, you know, they probably, the people that are imposing these systems on us feel that, oh, it's automated. What can they possibly do? Why would they even need to object to a ticket? These sorts of things, but you know that's not really the point. The point is we're supposed to be able to, as citizens, come back on these things and have an avenue for dealing with what we feel might be unfair treatment on the hands of these sorts of things. And I think that's probably one of the most irksome things about this. What do y'all think?
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Mark Seiden.
Well, in a recent USA Today article, the CEO, the new CEO of Redflex, admits, as an industry, we have not always met the corporate governance standards that our clients deserve. Now, I think when you have a situation where you have profit motive on one side and public good on the other side, human nature being what it is, the profit motive is going to win every time. And I think it's ripe for corruption, that particular industry. It's against the best interest of the citizens, and it does not have a proven effect that it reduces deaths and injuries on the road.
Lots of emails and tweets. Don emails the show. There are signs at intersections. You are alerted on multiple maps and traffic apps about the red light cameras. Here's an email from David. Red light cameras have been sold as a money generator. That's true for the short term until people realize which intersections are controlled by the cameras. Then the income falls off. How do you put a price on lives saved? Red light cameras do save lives, and that should be their primary purpose, not income generation. And here are a few tweets. We knew about the bribery allegations when we let Redflex in. Why do we do business with companies like Redflex? Tweets one listener to the show. Let's go now to Chris in Mandarin. Hi, Chris. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that any involvement in bribery obviously is atrocious, but I have no problem with a company making money off something that they've created and they maintain. And I also don't have a problem with the city making money off of it. The one thing that everybody forgets, and this comment may be naive or simplistic, but if you do not run the red light, you won't get a ticket. And this won't be an issue for you personally. I don't believe that there's an increased fine by running a red light managed by a camera as opposed to running a red light that's not managed by a camera.
That's Chris in Mandarin. Paul Henry, what about that argument?
Great points, and that's one that I really candidly am sick and tired of hearing, because there's a fellow by the name of Steve Hunt in Jacksonville that a number of years ago got a camera ticket. Now, Mr. Hunt did not run a red light. The camera ticket came from North Miami. It showed a Mercedes-Benz running a red light. They missed the tag number by one digit and mailed Mr. Hunt a ticket. He gets it. He says, I've got a GMC pickup truck. Check my registration. They said, no, you've got to come to court to do that. And that spurred me to look into these, and there have been a number of cases of what I call innocent owners ticketed in this scheme. And then he's got to make a 600-mile round trip to go down there to prove he didn't do something when their own video exonerated him, and they refused to do anything. That took place in Orlando. It's taken place in Tampa, where an officer guessed at a tag number. So this, just don't run the red light and you won't get a ticket. Yeah, that might work about 99% of the time. But what about these 1% cases where it doesn't? And by the way, that does not happen when a police officer writes somebody a ticket. And I do not support anybody running a red light. I think police officers need to give them tickets.
Well, this is certainly a hot topic this Monday morning as we discuss red light cameras in Florida. Lots of comments on our Facebook page. Here's one. I think it's completely predictable that a private company is getting rich on a deal that never provided what it promised. Have they actually reduced accidents? Mark Seiden, that is the question. You know, when companies evaluate whether to re-up with Redflex, Jacksonville will too. They'll have to make that call. Have they reduced accidents in Duval County?
And the answer to that simply is, I don't know. I haven't seen any data that proves that they do. And the problem that I have is they are delegating a law enforcement function to a private company. And law enforcement should remain with police agency. I think increasing traffic patrols at problem intersections is far more effective than simply taking a picture of an allegedly offending car. The officer's eyes are much better than a camera system.
Daniel in Middleburg. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. My biggest problem with red lights is they're just a revenue generator. If the cities and states keep cutting taxes this way, the cities have to find a way to generate revenue. And John Oliver did an awesome piece on last week with John Oliver about municipalities and how they're upping their profit margin by, instead of raising taxes, with all different fines. And I think the red lights are just another way for cities to kind of just recoup lost tax revenue. And if every city just had a good, decent, progressive tax rate, we'd see a lot of the need for this to go away. What do you guys think?
That's Daniel in Middleburg. Paul Henry.
Well, I don't think that any city that I'm aware of is really cutting taxes. That's the problem. Spending's the problem. That's a topic for a show. But he's certainly right. I mean, these cameras are used for revenue, and it becomes a crutch that the cities become dependent upon. And one thing that a lot of people don't realize, and this is something the city auditor pointed out here in Tallahassee in 2012, is that we have 7 intersections with 19 cameras. This city expends roughly $5,000 a month in employee costs. Now, once they're losing money, as they've done since July 2013, that's borne by the taxpayer. So that's an unforeseen cost of this camera scheme that a lot of people are not aware of. And, of course, that does impact the taxpayer. It's city revenue that's being spent.
Mark Seiden.
I think another big problem with the red light cameras is basically you're guilty until you're proven innocent, which is totally contrary to our system of criminal justice. You get one of these tickets, you get it in the mail, and it's going to cost you a lot of time and money to fight the ticket. You may not even been the person that's driving the car. You're just a registered owner. But nonetheless, you get hit with the ticket, you get hit with the fine, and it's your burden to prove that it wasn't you driving the car at the time.
Well, isn't that the case if you get a ticket, if someone has your car and there's an accident, as the owner of the car, you might be liable in some sense?
Well, you're civilly liable, but you're not liable in terms of being in traffic court and in terms of having points assessed against your license. If it was a police officer that pulled you over, he knows who you are. He looks at your license. He writes the right person the ticket, not the owner of the car, but the driver of the vehicle.
Let's go to John in Riverside. Hi, John. Good morning.
Morning. Kind of a question along the same lines, whether or not this violates our right to due process. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, John. Let's ask our lawyer on that one as well.
I think it does. I think it violates the basic American principle of justice, which is that you are innocent until you are proven guilty, and it's the state's burden to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. It shifts the burden of proof. It's a denial of due process. And in my opinion, it's illegal. And some of these cases are being contested on that basis.
Let's go to Dave and Glenn Kernan now. Hi, Dave. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Actually, I wanted to relay my experience. First of all, my impression of this of your program is I'm shocked to learn that there's potential corruption in Southern politics.
Right.
But that being said, I actually have had an experience where I received a notice for a traffic violation that I didn't commit. And I had no more difficulty than just a phone call. I don't know if it was red light related or sun pass related, but all I had to do was I called the number, spoke with the person, gave them my license number, which was obviously wrong, different from what they had recorded. And they said, okay, no problem, done. And so, I mean, others may have had difficulty with that. I did not.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Paul Henry, the corruption allegations in other states against red flags are quite serious, both in Ohio and in Illinois. But there, to be fair to this company, nobody's accusing red flags of bribing Florida officials.
No, Melissa, that's because it hasn't been investigated yet. As the saying goes, the truism where there's smoke, there's fire. And so the question is, if they engaged in this pattern of misconduct in Ohio and in Illinois, it's quite possible they did so in Florida. And when you look at the money that's involved, the campaign donations alone, of hundreds of thousands of dollars going to politicians, Democrat and Republican alike, and that's something I want to make clear, that this is not a Republican or a Democrat battle. I like to say it's not a red versus blue battle. It's a red, white, and blue American justice, as the attorney mentioned, versus green money. And so there's a tremendous amount of money involved, and by our human nature, whenever there's that type of money involved, corruption generally follows.
Lowell in Mandarin. Hi, Lowell. How are you today? Go ahead.
Hey. Yeah, I have to back up a bunch of these guys. If they're saying that 99% of the tickets are good, 1% is bad, then obviously we don't have that problem. If you've ever driven through Phillips Highway and Bay Meadows before the cameras went in, you saw the carnage there daily. It does seem to work. You know, the other deal is you couldn't put enough police officers at, again, Phillips Highway and Bay Meadows to stop it all. You would just, you know, you talk about a profit center. That's one corner in Jacksonville that needed the cameras, got the cameras, and it definitely slowed the problem down. So at this point in time, I see no issue with it. Like the sheriff said, stop running the red lights. All you got to do is sit in some of these corners and realize we need something. And since the city can't hire more policemen, this seems to be the obvious way to go. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Lowell. That was the rationale for bringing this program to Jacksonville, Mark. And former Sheriff Rutherford made that case on this program many a time.
And I respect Sheriff Rutherford, both personally and professionally, but I disagree on the enforcement method. Motorcycle officers are especially effective in targeting traffic problems. And when you put several motorcycle officers on a problem intersection and they write a number of tickets within a 1 week or a 3 day period, it's going to slow down the red light running at that intersection without the necessity of cameras.
Let's get a few more of your calls on the air. Joe is downtown. Hi, Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Good morning. Why am I not surprised that a company whose business model is bribing public officials chose Jacksonville to come and set up business? Another issue that I found is new around the state of Florida is taking pictures of automobiles on a highway and sending them a toll notes. Down in South Florida, they'll take a picture of your automobile, send you a toll, a 52-cent toll, and a $2.50 administration fee to take a picture of your car.
Thanks, Joe. Well, you relocated up here from South Florida.
I did, and I'm much happier here in Northeast Florida.
Well, we're glad to have you.
Thank you. But I think it's interesting to note, getting back to the potential for bribery, that on June 19th, the Chicago Tribune reported that the former CEO of Redflex had pleaded guilty in a federal bribery investigation in Ohio. Also, a Tribune investigation uncovered wrongdoing in a Chicago contract with allegations involving bribes paid to politically connected people. Now, if this is a straight industry, if this is an industry that is designed to benefit the public and not just line its own pockets, then why do we have these bribery cases? Why do we have these executives pleading guilty to federal corruption?
Let's take one more call. It's Marius in downtown Jackson. Hi, Marius. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. Thank you so much for taking my call this morning. Just a quick question, and I got in the car a little bit late, so if it's been answered, I do sincerely apologize. The whole notion with my concern is, I've been very interested in this, is because I've seen a lot of people, and I've heard of several people getting away with it as well. The whole, well, all you have to do is write them a letter, because a camera cannot come to court and testify against you. And if you write a letter that says this is abusing my amendment right to face my accuser, and since a camera cannot come to court, you know, and then also if you ask for the latest maintenance records of that camera, a lot of times nobody ever got a response back, and it was as if it never happened.
Thanks, Marius. And here's another comment for you, Paul Henry. Do we know anything about, and this is on our Facebook page, what do we know about the contract between Redflex and Duval County? If red light tickets decrease, does Duval still have to pay some minimum contract fee to the company? Paul Henry.
Usually that's not the case. I have not looked at Jacksonville's contract, but here in Tallahassee, there was a saving clause that saved the taxpayer about $1 million. They said, we've lost money since July 2013. If the city had to pay that, they'd be even in worse shape than they are now. Yeah. But what happened was, the way most of these contracts are written, they're what are called revenue neutral, which a California court held was basically illegal. And if you accrue more debt than you do profit on these cameras, and then at the end of the contract, the company will normally write that off. I suspect that's probably the case here in Jacksonville, but without having read the contract, I would not know.
Let's close with you, Mark Seiden. How do you see this investigation unfolding?
Well, I see them doing a very thorough job and taking a lot of testimony. The question is, what's it going to produce? Is it going to be whistle clean, or is it going to show an uncomfortable underbelly of contributions and perhaps bribes? I hope not. I hope that it is legitimate and on the up and up, but only time will tell.
We'll have to follow it. In the meantime, gentlemen, thank you both so much for joining the program. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
Thank you.
We were joined by Paul Henry, a retired Florida State Trooper, speaking out against the red light cameras via the Liberty First Network, and attorney and Florida Coastal School of Law Professor Mark Seiden this morning. Later, Culpepper on the Armada's dramatic win over the weekend. But up next, how you can light a spark here in the city. We'll explain.
WJZT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJZT-TV and radio. Submit now through July 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
I told Watson, if I ever write a story myself, it will be to correct the myriad misconceptions created by his imaginative license.
In the new film Mr. Holmes, Ian McKellen plays an aged Sherlock Holmes, now in retirement with a failing mind. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with McKellen about acting and about being closeted in England when it was a crime to admit being gay. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Even in tough economic times, there are many local stories of success. I'm Karen Mathis with the Daily Record. On First Coast Success, I speak with Northeast Florida business executives and entrepreneurs about their experiences and accomplishments. Hear the interviews the last Monday of each month on First Coast Connect or on demand at wjctnews.org.
Brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
New name, new look. Join us for our annual Women's Health Conference, Girls Day Out, August 15th, Hyatt Regency Hotel. Morning keynote speaker, mental health advocate Jessie Close, who wants to change how people talk and think about mental illness. An ambassador for Bring Change to Mind, a not-for-profit organization founded by Jessie's sister, actress Glenn Close. Jessie fights stigma and misunderstandings to create a clearer picture of mental disorders. Good for you. Girls Day Out is hosted by Baptist Health and WJCT. For a complete list of speakers or to purchase your tickets, log on to wjct.org/goodforyou.
Welcome back. Well, it's your chance to light a spark in Jacksonville. The Cultural Council is accepting applications right now for its Spark Grant program, and an important deadline is just around the corner. Here to tell us more, Tony Allegretti, Executive Director of the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Always good to see you.
Good morning.
And here with us as well, Darnell Smith, Market President for North Florida, Florida Blue.
Good morning.
Good to see you guys. Tony, let's start with you. This is the third year of the Spark Grant Program, which is such a great initiative. Tell us all about it.
Well, yes, it's the third year. We activate downtown with a certain number of grants from artists. We've had a really great run to date, and so this will be the biggest one in the history of the Spark District. So we've got $70,000 worth of grants for artists and projects downtown. Very exciting.
And so money you want to give away to people to fund their ideas.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's super cool. And we've had a lot of success. If you've looked at in the past at our Spark grantees, a lot of them are still rolling. I mean, you've got a sculpture walk out on Main Street Park. You've got Ian Swamp Radio. In fact, he had a big show in St. Augustine this weekend. You know, they keep rolling right along. And so the seed money is crucial, and it's a lot of fun.
And Darnell, Florida Blue recognizes the impact of Spark in terms of supporting the arts and economic development that stems from the arts. This cycle, you're doing something new, the Florida Blue Flame. What's that all about?
Oh, absolutely. So we will sponsor the Florida Blue Flame Special Project category. These grants focus primarily on arts and culture projects that really help around the health and the wellness of the community. We focus on seniors, children, teens, families, et cetera. And it's really about helping Florida just be, Jacksonville in particular, to be a very healthy and active environment. And so we're really happy to be a part of that. And so this is really about artists that really can bring together those kind of projects.
And the deadline to apply is coming up, Tony. What types of projects are you looking for? What are some of the guidelines?
Well, we're real open. You know, in fact, when you look at our application, which is at theculturalcouncil.org, you'll see that we don't have a ton of parameters. It's not really prescribed except for what Darnell's talking about with the Florida Blue Flame. It does give a little bit of a narrative to it. But frankly, the community and the artists themselves come up with things that we couldn't even imagine. So we don't try to transcribe what that is.
Darnell.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's awesome because, you know, health of a community is measured by far more than just traditional wellness. And so as we look at the kinds of projects that they can really bring forward. We want it to be their imagination. What we want more than anything else is the opportunity for that out-of-the-box thinking mm-hmm. that just might give us something that we don't have within the community and maybe not even within the industry. And we take that, we can then be able to support it. And before you know it, it could be something that's not just for here in Jacksonville. It might be something that is across the entire nation.
It's so exciting. And Tony, you talk about this a lot. A small investment in arts and culture really pays off big dividends.
Sure. So for many artists who are going to apply, this is probably more money than they've ever been able to put in, invest in a project. So that in that way, it's great. But if you look at, you know, just sort of the ripple effects of some of these projects, you know, I think of Mal Jones, who was one of our last cycle winners. He's done a really fascinating JEA commercial with kids, and his interaction with kids and hip hop and how that sort of that goodwill ripples out is just an amazing investment. So it's a starting block, I think, for a lot of these artists, hopefully.
Now, as I said, August 6th is the deadline for guidelines and eligibility requirements. All you need to go to culturalcouncil.org/spark2016. Florida Blue really throwing in with this. And the award amounts, Darnell, they go up to $30,000. Isn't that right?
That is correct. Now, we are actually putting $45,000 in. So that's going to be a part. That's our contribution there. And the award can go up to $30,000. But I got to tell you, we simply want everybody's best ideas.
You know, you mentioned Swamp Radio a minute ago, Tony. Ian Mayers created that idea, a variety show, radio show done on stage. He's done it several times now. We've aired it here on 89.9. That's one really good example of what a Spark grant can do and get started.
That's right, yeah. And so we're super proud of Ian, but, you know, all of the Spark grantees have punched above their weight. I mean, we're really seeing some good energy behind it. And what I love about the, you know, with the district right now in downtown is downtown's really getting its sea legs. We're coming into our own and having almost performance or experience based grants like these help with some of the art infrastructure that we're putting in too. So, you know, we've got a lot of public art projects downtown. This is another way to just sort of energize the street.
And let's talk about that for a minute, because anyone applying for this, Darnell, it has to be within what's known as the Spark District. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So as we look at the work here in Jacksonville, it's really around Jacksonville. It's around the opportunity to really help with the healthy, active communities. And then, of course, for the quality of life improvement within Jacksonville.
And there's this really strong focus, Tony, on the urban core, on bringing this creative energy to this certain radius of square blocks downtown. Can you explain why?
Sure. Well, it's all about where people are gathering. It's where we're convening now. If you look at, you know, Hemming Plaza is a home run, and it's thriving every day. There's activity in there. And now if you're a grantee, maybe you can do your art project around it because you've got a permit. You've got, you know, they've already got the infrastructure with the insurance and that sort of thing. And so downtown is now the conditions are set for these artists to come in and make things work. And so that, mm-hmm. that first cluster, that downtown Spark District becomes a peach tree dish.
Yeah.
So with all of that said, the deadline is coming up. Let's get mm-hmm. the information out once again to people that have been listening and they might want to apply. What do they need to do?
Right. So they go to culturalcouncil.org/spark2016. There's also, we did a workshop, sort of a pre deadline workshop, and you can listen to that online, get the tips, so you won't have missed anything, and do the application. I would say, you know, don't sweat it. It is going to be very competitive. So if you've got a great idea, don't ever give up on your idea, even if you don't make it this cut. It's my job to make sure that we have grants for artists and projects. So.
Absolutely. And whatever you do, don't not submit something because you're disqualifying yourselves. We want you, if you think it's a great idea, just share it, submit it, allow us to be able to look at it. You never know. It could be that one that hits the home run.
Yeah, you never know. So just go to culturalcouncil.org/spark2016, submit your idea to get a Spark grant. Award amounts range between $10,000 to $30,000, but the deadline is August 6th, so act now. Tony Allegretti and Darnell Smith, always great to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Back in a moment with Culpepper and Sports.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to WJCT/teach.
Relax Radio WJCT 89.9 HD3 is your music station, playing the songs you remember best from the Beatles, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, and Motown, 24 hours a day, only on WJCT 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Hey, it's John Moe, the host of Wits, a new show recorded live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. Some of the top names in comedy and music join us each week for sketches.
You are so far outside the box right now, you are back in the box.
Music.
I'm out of the game.
And life's big questions. How's it going?
It's going great, man. This is a wonderful program.
Saturday night at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas. Des Moines. Topeka. Montana.
Cleveland. San Francisco. Denver. Philadelphia. Minneapolis.
Miami. Colorado. Washington.
You will own your morning, wherever you are, when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News. Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, a massive and unexpected win for the Armada.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Culpepper is here now with a look at sports and the Armada's big Saturday night. Hey, Cole.
Hello. It was a big Saturday night because the New York Cosmos, the undefeated New York Cosmos, came to town. The Armada was also playing without five of their regular starters, including leading playmaker Marcos Flores and goalkeeper Miguel Gallardo. Flores was injured, and his replacement, Inglewood High and JU alum Tommy Krizanovich, scored the only goal of the match, while Gallardo's replacement, David Sierra, made save after save against the Cosmos. The Armada won 1-0. Let me try to put in context how big a win this was. The Armada had been struggling to score goals. They hadn't scored in any of the first three games of the fall season, all on the road. They hadn't won at home since May, partly because of the schedule, and they hadn't had a lot of home games since May. And no NASL team had beaten New York since last November.
Wow.
This was a huge win. The Armada are off this weekend, then back at it on Friday, July 31st, at home against Minnesota United. Great crowd as well. Over 8,000 were watching the Armada at Community First Park.
Very nice.
At the same time, across the street at the arena, over 9,000 were announced as the Sharks got a big win over the Philadelphia Soul. They're now 8-7 on the season, still in contention for the playoffs. So it was a busy Saturday at the sports
complex.
Yeah,
busy Saturday in the sports complex. It's always great to see that energy down there, see the teams win. I mean, that gives them both some nice momentum.
No doubt about it. I was not in the arena while the Sharks were playing. I was calling the game for the Armada. But afterwards, you could see people coming out. Armada fans were all excited. And then all of a sudden, here come the Sharks fans wearing their Sharks gear, and they're excited about it. So it's, once again, we've had this conversation about this time of year. Once upon a time was the
the dead time.
The dead zone, yeah, yeah.
In Jacksonville, not anymore.
Isn't July 15th, like, billed around the country as, like, a day without sports or something like that?
Yeah, usually it's the day after the Major League Baseball All-Star Game. Once upon a time, that was the case, but that's
not so much anymore.
Not anymore at all.
That's good news for Cole Pepper.
Hey, listen, somebody's got to call these games, right? Also on this day, we would usually be talking about the winner of the British Open, but the elements at St. Andrews have forced a Monday finish for just the second time in history. And this is a tournament that began when Abraham Lincoln was in office. They were not too concerned about Abe Lincoln back then in Scotland at St. Andrews.
No, not so much.
But they're playing at historic St. Andrews, and they'll do their best to finish today. Louis Oosthuizen, Jason Day, and amateur Paul Dunn started the day in the lead at 12 under par. Dunn has bogeyed the first hole. Oosthuizen has birdied to get to 13 under. But keep an eye out for Jason Day. And then also Jordan Spieth, the young American who won both the Masters and the U.S. Open, very much in contention at 11 under par, just a stroke back as the final round begins today. And if he wins this tournament, there will be an unprecedented amount of coverage for this young man when the PGA Championship rolls around, because nobody in the modern history of golf has won the four majors as they sit right now.
Who does he compare to when you look at the sweeping history of golf?
Oh, you know, he is not a bomber. So the recent guys like Tiger and Rory McIlroy, Mickelson to a certain extent, he is a straight, steady kind of player. And I'll compare him to... And we haven't seen the kind of dogged competitiveness just yet. That has to play out over time. But the first name that pops to my mind is Tom Watson, who was a great British Open champion, five-time winner at the British, who played his final round at St. Andrews on Friday and was shown off in great style. But I got competitive, steady, and just does everything well. And I'd say that's the first name that pops to mind. There are probably better comparisons, but... we need to see more of how his career lays out and how he really performs under pressure to see how he's done. But so far this year, he's been just fantastic.
And how old is Jordan Spieth?
22, 23.
Gosh,
yeah,
he's a baby,
he
isn't
is.
He?
Yep, absolutely. Wow. He would still be in college, I think, actually. He would have been graduated from college about the same time he won the Masters this year.
Yeah, well, a great career still ahead of him. And last but not least, it's almost time for Jaguars training camp.
Right, 11 days away from the start of training camp. This time next month, we'll be talking about preseason games. But for now, let's talk about a couple of Jaguars players and how they were spending their time before training camp. So a lot of folks, when they're on vacation, who live around the First Coast, what do? They play some golf.
Yeah.
Not everybody gets a chance to do what Josh Gobe and Blake Bortles did, though, playing in the Lake Tahoe Celebrity Golf Tournament.
It's a little fancier than some of us.
A little fancier. And Scobie, who has wanted to play in this tournament for years and years, is a terrific golfer. He's competed in U.S. Open qualifiers in the past. He actually led this tournament after the second of three rounds. He won, finishing third out of the entire field behind two former Major League pitchers, Mark Mulder and Eric Gagne. Among the celebrities that played, Justin Timberlake, Charles Barkley, who's horrible at golf.
Is he really?
Oh, he finishes, I think he finished last again this year. Bortles, by the way, beat him and one other guy. Huh. So not as good a round for Bortles as it was for Scobie. They were on opposite ends of the scoreboard. Alfonso Ribeiro, remember Carlton from Fresh Prince?
From Fresh Prince.
Yeah.
How's he on the links?
I don't
Pretty
know.
Good?
I think he's a better dancer than a golfer. Olympic skier Bodie Miller. Women's soccer star from the past, Brandi Chastain. Actor Dennis Haysbert.
I love him.
I mean, what a great voice, right?
Love that guy.
Yeah, and former model Kim Alexis, a former First Coast
that's
resident.
That's right, but she no longer lives here, correct?
I think that's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And Steve Spurrier were among those who were playing in this tournament. And this has become an annual thing and draws a great crowd, and it's on TV. And, I mean, Scobie just did such a great job. They play in what's called a modified stableford scoring system, so it's a little different than you would score it in a different classic round of golf. But he shot 66 on Saturday, and then shot 71, one under par yesterday.
Pretty amazing.
Pretty good for as he's been saying, he's been asking to get into this thing for so long. He's been one of the best golfers in the NFL. A lot of the guys who wind up winning it are, for some reason, are former pitchers and former quarterbacks, for whatever reason.
It's nice, though, to see the Jaguars getting some attention elsewhere. And I can't believe training camp's around the corner. Time flies by, but it's always pleasant to spend a little time with you on Mondays. So As always, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
Cole Pepper, follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper, and that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Our podcast is up every day at iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, as investigators look into the motives and connections of the Kuwaiti-born U.S. citizen who attacked military centers in Tennessee, we'll hear the latest on the deadly shooting and the threat of domestic terrorism. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.